Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. Michelle Perkins is back yet again, and we're going to do a back-to-back with two different topics as two different podcasts. The first is about hyperkalemia, and the second is about dry drowning, or the lack thereof. So, without any further ado, Michelle Perkins, in case somehow someone has listened to this podcast, but not to you yet, can you introduce yourself?
Absolutely, Chip. Thank you so much for having me back. My name is Michelle Perkin. I'm an ER doc in rural down East Maine, and have really enjoyed doing these podcasts with you, Chip.
Well, I've enjoyed them a lot, and you have done so many different things throughout your career. And I learned of a new one today, is that you're also a medical examiner. So you've been like, you've done the OBGYN type thing when you're doing the family practice side, because that came up during our vaginal ultrasound thing. But now that we are talking about something else, and you just happened to say that you're doing a medical examiner's case. I did not know that you did the medical examination side as well.
Yeah, that's a pretty fun side to it, to be sure. I don't do a ton of it. I do usually a couple cases a month, but it's kind of a good community service thing to do. And the people at the ME's office are just so darn nice. You want to work with them.
That's great. So hopefully our patients in either one of these that we're going to talk about won't need your expertise, but let's talk first about hyperkalemia. We hear about it all the time. We see it quite a bit in the lab work, but really, why should we worry about hyperkalemia? What does this even mean?
Well, I mean, potassium is a pretty important thing in the body. And without getting all weird and biochemy, it's important to have some idea what it does in the body in order to really understand how to treat it. The resting electrical potential of the cell membranes is very dependent on the ratio of extracellular to intracellular potassium. And this equilibrium is pretty delicate, and it's regulated mostly by insulin and catecholamines, and it really doesn't take much to mess this up. Just a little bit of change in the extracellular potassium can have a major impact on cell membrane stability.
Okay, and we worry about it because it does a lot of things, especially to the heart, right?
Right. I mean, these patients will die if you don't take care of it quickly and appropriately.
So who should we be suspecting this in to start with?
Well, the most common folks that present with this are people with kidney problems. It's usually an excretion issue as far as the potassium goes. But you can also get endogenous overload of potassium with increased potassium generated by cell death, like all the lyses that you see, hemolysis, rhabdo, tumor lysis, tissue lysis due to trauma or burns.
And rhabdo is one I think we tend to forget about, I think, the most. Like the others, it kind of makes sense and you can figure through, but I feel like rhabdo is the one that a lot of times we forget to really think about how that potassium plays that role in there. I don't know. Maybe that's just the group of people I work with and the fact that we don't see rhabdo a whole lot in our area.
Right. Yeah. I think it's one we all tend to forget.
Okay. So we have some clue about like what we should be looking for history wise, things like that, but how do they actually present?
Well, they could present kind of across the spectrum. You can have someone who's completely asymptomatic, and that's not uncommon at all. But you could also have these super vague symptoms like generalized weakness or palpitations or even some paresthesias or paralysis even. And sometimes they present the worst possible way in a PEA arrest. That's not uncommon at all.
I feel like the asymptomatic thing is something we see a lot in the ED type settings because someone goes to their doctor's office. A lot of times it's just for routine blood work. And then they get redirected to come here a couple hours later because their potassium is a little up. Usually it's not anything real significant. They've had that potassium for a long time, but they're asymptomatic, but it's a higher level. It's a panic level. And so they get redirected to us. So I feel like I see that one a lot. The other ones, like you talked about, sometimes they're just really vague symptoms. Or in the cardiac arrest situations, you have to figure out, especially when you're talking about like dialysis patients or those other types of unique patient populations that are more pre-exposed to those types of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really common to see really high levels in dialysis patients be asymptomatic because that's just kind of where they live a lot of the time.
Right. So what can we do to actually see this objectively besides, you know, just blood work?
Well, the major thing is EKG. So we're taught pretty classically that you see very typical progressive EKG changes. And that's not a wrong way to be taught it. I mean, what we are taught is that first you start getting the peak T waves that you see, and then you just see that weird kind of wide QRS morphology. Then you lose your P waves, and then you get kind of like a slow VTAC morphology that you see. And then that morphs into the sine wave morphology, where the QRS has gotten so weird and so wide that it's just kind of morphing into the T wave. And then you progress to V-fib and then asystole. But you can't really count on this, because that classic spectrum isn't always classic. Sometimes you can go from a totally normal EKG to PEA or asystole, especially in those renal patients that live at the higher potassium. They can go very quickly from a normal EKG to a potentially life-threatening rhythm.
And at that same notion, I've seen some really high potassiums without any EKG changes, not even the peak T waves. So I don't feel like you can just say, like I've seen some dogma where it's, well, it's most likely between this and this range for your potassium if you see these EKG findings. It highly depends on the person, depends on the rate of change, as we were talking about as well. So again, the EKG is important, because that sometimes can say, hey, this is someone who's at a higher risk for having some downstream effects, but don't necessarily rely on that as far as your actual potassium level. Okay, so we've talked about how recognizing and how the EKG could play a role in everything else. And again, that the values may not necessarily always add up. So how do we decide how to treat these patients?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is the cutoff number that people give, which I think is reasonable. If the potassium is greater than 6.5, regardless of any EKG changes, then you treat emergently. But if the potassium is greater than 5 with EKG changes, you treat emergently. So basically, you don't count entirely on the EKG and the numbers. It's more of the combination of the two. And if you get a potassium that is greater than 5 but less than 6.5 without any EKG changes, then you just, the treatment isn't quite as emergent.
Okay, so what's the emergent treatment like?
Well, if you think about it, if the patient's having abnormalities on their EKG, their membranes are already destabilized. Job one is to stabilize those membranes. And what you reach for is calcium, because this restores kind of the normal membrane potential of the myocytes. And if you're concerned about the EKG changes or the clinical picture, just give it. You're not going to hurt the patient, and it's potentially life-saving, and the effect of it is nearly instantaneous.
Okay, and how do you give it?
Well, historically, it's been recommended to use calcium gluconate over calcium chloride, because it's less likely to cause tissue damage if there's an infiltrate. But the calcium chloride actually has more available calcium in the elemental form. And if a patient is crashing, you're really not going to worry all that much about the estravasation of your IV. It's kind of the least of their worries at that point. So basically, give what you have available. If you're giving calcium gluconate, understand that you might need more of it, like 3 amps of it rather than 1, than you would of the calcium chloride.
Right. And so this is kind of the tricky part, because people talk about how you should be doing the calcium gluconate, especially if you have a line that you're not so sure about, but it doesn't work as well in critically ill patients, which are the ones you want to actually give it to. So we do the calcium chloride instead. For those people who aren't very good about remembering which one's which, because I had that problem a lot, I still think about this. We give dextrose via peripheral IV, and we don't have any real grief with that. So if we give calcium gluconate, glucose makes me think of that as well. So if we give glucose peripherally, that's okay. And I remember the calcium chloride is the opposite of that. But that's just me. Maybe that's not as helpful to some people.
No, that's a good way to remember it. I hadn't thought about it that way.
So there's this weird thing that we hear about called stone heart. What is this?
Well, historically, if the hyperkalemia was felt to be due to digitoxicity, which is another cause that we didn't really talk about, it's been thought that sudden death due to, quote, stone heart was a concern with the calcium administration. And this was just based on some case studies of sudden deaths when calcium was administered in the face of hyper-K, in the face of digitoxicity, as well as some theoretical biochemical pathways that lead to myocyte standstill, blah, blah, blah. The bottom line, this has been debunked. I mean, that's just one of the reasons that people had cautioned about just giving calcium if you were worried. So the treatment of hyperkalemia caused by digitoxicity is digibine. But if you're seeing EKG changes consistent with hyperkalemia and you think digits evolved, just give the calcium. Don't worry about it.
So yet another piece of dogma that we see a lot that, again, with hyperkalemia, probably isn't actually the real issue here. And again, give what needs to be done, do the emergent treatment, that's the calcium, and again, recognize that there are some real limitations on the previous research that was there.
Indeed.
Now, what about with DIGE? I'm curious for you, because we're practicing two totally different environments. Do you see much DIGE use? Because I don't anymore.
No, thankfully we don't. It seems to be falling farther and farther by the wayside as some of the older school cardiologists have been retiring on their yachts.
Okay, so what about hypertonic saline, the 3% stuff?
Right. Well, this has a role in the acute management only in the setting of concurrent hyponatremia. And its role is one of membrane stabilization as well, similar to calcium, but it works synergistically with the calcium and doesn't affect the potassium levels at all. So that really only has a role when you're hyponatremic as well.
Because the only one I can really think of is sometimes with some DKA patients I've seen this, but that's that are that bad that they're actually, like, in some cases there's some rhabdo along with it or something goofy. Rhabdo is the other one that I sometimes see that in, but not a lot.
No, not. I was trying to kind of racking my brain because you usually see the hypernatremia with hyperkalemia in many instances. So, but that is where that role would come in anyway.
So anyway, it's just something I thought about because, again, you don't see this a lot, but when you do, it's sometimes nice to know and plan ahead. But most of the time, you're not going to have to worry about the hypertonic saline. It's just good to know that if you've got that going on, it's safe to do both the hypertonic and the calcium with it as well.
Indeed.
All right. So what about, you know, yeah, we're treating and we're doing the emergent stabilization with our calcium and whatnot, but we also have to identify what is the underlying problem, right?
Right, absolutely. So what we need to do is take care of what's causing these problems, and that would be getting rid of the potassium. And basically, the best way to do that is to get it from extracellular back into intracellular.
Okay, and the best way to do that is?
Well, as we mentioned before, insulin is the major regulator of the equilibrium, so insulin is the answer. It drives the extracellular potassium back into the cells. So basically what you do is you generally administer 10 units of IV insulin given with D50, which is equal to 2 amps, to prevent hypoglycemia. And the 10 units will typically drive down the potassium by 0.6 milliequivalents within 10 to 15 minutes. And you can just repeat this ad lib.
And something else to keep in mind, because you mentioned this, the idea of giving dextrose along with it is to help prevent the hypoglycemia. That's a more in a normal glycemic patient. However, if they're hypoglycemic, you'll have to give them obviously more. And then in the very high patients, again, these DKA situations where that weird things happen like this sometimes, then you probably won't actually necessarily need to give the dextrose with the IV insulin.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see people try to get all weird and fancy and put the insulin in a bag of D50 and then run it a certain way. And it's too much of a mess. Just give the insulin and then give the D50 in amp form, if that's what you're going to do.
All right. And then there are some other things that you can do to help drive out that extracellular potassium as well, correct?
Absolutely. Like we talked about before, catecholamines also play a role along with insulin in that potassium equilibrium across the membrane. So beta agonists such as albuterol can mimic catecholamines and cause the potassium to be driven into the cells. And so generally the dose is a lot higher than what you use with bronchospasm, generally 10 to 20 milligrams nebulized, but it works really synergistically with the insulin and the glucose combo, and it can lower another 0.6 milliequivalents per dose. But you can't give it alone. If you give it without insulin, it can actually make your potassium go up.
And actually, I sometimes order this. We already have an order set for an hour-long neb at 15 milligrams, so I do that in addition to the insulin and the dextrose.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All these other things, we already talked about the main ones, probably the ones that are most research-based and evidence-based, but there are some other things we can do to eliminate the potassium still, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there are things you can do just to get the potassium out of the system, not just drive it intracellularly. And the number one thing you think of is diuretics, because it eliminates potassium via the kidneys. And they actually still will work if you've got a patient with bad kidneys. Giving diuretics will still work with this, but it will only work if a patient is hypervolemic and not hypovolemic. And it doesn't work as well and as quickly as insulin and albuterol. So this does take some time for it to be eliminated that route.
What about our frenemy, the thing that people always love to mention, sodium bicarb?
Yeah. Well, in this instance, it may actually help, used as a drip, not as a push. And basically what it does is it alkalizes the urine, and that increases your potassium excretion. But like the diuretics, this is not a quick fix.
Okay. The one that everyone's been waiting for, the one that everyone has probably been thinking every time we're talking about getting rid of potassium. KX-Lite.
Ugh, KX-Lite. Yeah, I still have no idea why it's still stocked in our ED, but it's a no. I mean, it theoretically works by binding potassium in the intestine, but I say theoretically, it's theoretic that it actually works at all. It's very variable as far as how efficacious it is, and it's been shown in some cases to cause intestinal necrosis. So this is not a treatment acutely for hyperkalemia. Even though it's still stocked, it's still touted as one, it's not.
This is my big one, because I know why we still have it in ours, and that's because nephrology wants it, because that's what they're still encouraging us to use. I hate it. I hate it every time. And our nurses hate it too for a different reason. If you've never used KX-Lite before, just ask one of your nurses. I'm sure they've had to give KX-Lite before. No one likes to give it. And it's not just because people start having diarrhea and stuff like that. It's truly because it can cause some issues. I know you briefly glanced over this, but you know, whether or not it even works is a big issue. The studies were very small that we've based all this off of. And then we have some real issues that come up, like the intestinal necrosis. This is no minor thing. This is major surgery. People die from this. And yet we're still using KX-Lite quite a bit, even though this is probably one of our weakest ones of evidence. And when I've talked to people about this before, some people are just stuck in the ways of, well, we've always done this before, or I've done this and I haven't noticed any issues myself. Well, a lot of times you're not going to be the one who gets it, because you're going to hand this patient off downstream. What happens downstream, though, is the big thing that comes up.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's actually still people out there that are touting still using the retention enemas, which was the thing back in the day. So if you really want to necros that colon, that's the best way to go.
And then there's some newer stuff, right? There's some potassium binders out there.
Yep, there's two. One's called Deltasa and the other one is Z59. As you said, they're both potassium binders. Deltasa is approved here and Z59 is approved in Europe and for some reason was rejected here. They don't really have a role emergently regardless. This is more for the chronic hyperkalemia and really don't have any role in the emergent treatment. So these are more what your nephrologist will be giving as an outpatient, most likely.
And I like this because I've seen KX-Lite be used for chronic hyperkalemia, and I really just did not like that idea. So when Veltasa came up, this is actually what led to us even talking about doing a hyperkalemia talk, because it seems like so many people have done this well before. Why do we even mention it now? And this little one was just kind of something that stuck out in my mind, and it was worth talking about it to see how it's used. And realistically, it's not something we're going to be using, but it's going to be people down the line who are going to use this, and it's worth knowing about at least.
Right. Or if they come in on it, that would be nice to know what it is on their med list as kind of a clue.
Wait, you actually get updated med lists?
I'm talking the unicorn shop that I don't actually work in. But
well, I can't say that anymore, because we have some great people at my place, my main shop, where they actually do their full-time job is to get the meds and reconcile them and everything. It's incredible. It's definitely changed some stuff for us, but sometimes I'm in and out of the room faster than they've ever been in there. And that becomes the whole tricky thing as well. But at least we're trying to keep up with this versus what we were doing before, which is our nurses were supposed to ask this, and they're not going to do that. They don't have enough time in addition to everything else they're being asked to do.
Wow. That sounds like an absolutely fascinating job.
Yeah. They get really excited for it, trust me, asking the same questions over and over again.
Seriously.
But in all reality, here's what it comes down to. We've talked about kind of the other stuff. We talked about emergent, but let's talk about like the hyperacute, the true emergency, a hyperkalemic cardiac arrest. How do we manage this?
Well, first and foremost, you follow the ACLS guidelines, but basically calcium, 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 and just watch the QRS morphology and kind of titrate to the morphology. If you see the morphology improving the calcium, then they need more. And if you're in doubt, I mean, if you get this patient come in, I mean, I know I had a partner of mine have a patient come in this weird bradycardia. and then arrested. And so there was just this weird morphology. Their P waves are gone at that point. So if you're seeing a weird morphology bradycardia, you're not going to be wrong just to give the calcium and get started that way. But obviously continuing to follow ACLS guidelines. And if you're in the PAA algorithm anyway, you're going to be using epi, which will help shift the potassium into the cells via the catecholamine pathway, like we were talking about with the albuterol. And again, as you're running the code, as you're doing your thing, you just continue with the insulin and the glucose and just keep going with that. So then you just continue the code until you get ROSC or you have your potassium normalized and you're still in arrest.
I think it's worth also mentioning here real quick when it comes to this, that if you have a patient who comes in, you kind of already said like this weird looking rhythm, but the slow VTAC, this is worth remembering here because most often when you see this, you're going to have someone say, oh, it looks like VTAC on the monitor, but you hear the beeping in the background, you hear the blips, and it's very slow.
Right.
And to me, that's a big cue when I look at this, that this isn't actually a true VTAC. This is something else. And I've actually caught a couple of cardiac arrests that way, where we recognize that this is actually a hyperkalemic cardiac arrest. And we do what you're talking about. Give them calcium, do whatever you can to help normalize the potassium and try and get this under control. So again, if you have someone who comes in cardiac arrest and they're saying, well, this is a slow looking VTAC, immediately think about potassium.
Right. That's always a very good thing to have in your back pocket. And it's also important to remember that if you do get ROSC, the calcium effect isn't going to last that long. So you really need to be working on the potassium in the background as you're doing all of this.
Yeah, and this is one of those, I think this would be a time when you want to do a drip or stuff like that if you haven't already done so.
Right.
Okay, so we've talked about potassium. We've gone the whole spectrum. We've talked about chronic. We've talked about acute. We've talked about the hyperacute all the way up to cardiac arrest. Is there anything else you want to add on managing hyperkalemia in the emergency department?
No, just have it in the back of your mind. If you've got this undifferentiated sick patient with a weird-looking EKG, even if, you know, they're not a renal patient, that type of thing, or you get a young healthy patient that may have rhabdo or something along those lines, they don't tolerate the higher level potassiums as well as those chronic renal patients who are basically living with potassium of 6 all the time. So those are the ones you really need to make sure you're jumping on because they can go from normal rhythm to arrest really quickly.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. And real quick, can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.